Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. Today we're going to be taking a look at an original versus remake episode of Solaris, comparing Andrei Tarkovsky's 1972 film with Steven Soderbergh's 2002 remake. Before we get to that, I'd like to get to a little feedback. I would like to thank a Reddit user named Scotty Like, who posted on the Batman subreddit a really, really nice post. Quote, "I never truly appreciated Batman Begins until I listened to this podcast," unquote. And he threw up a link to my Batman Begins podcast. So came out of nowhere. So I just wanted to thank Scotty Like for putting that up there. I wanted to thank some listeners, Jordan Burke and Curtis Hayes, for posting some info about some World War II facts that I was talking a little bit about in my Cap First Avenger podcast. I wasn't sure that Japanese Americans served, or Asian Americans for that matter, served in World War II. I was pretty sure they weren't integrated into the regular army units. But it was pointed out to me that they actually served in their own units. So they did serve. So Asian Americans did serve in the U.S. Armed Forces in World War II, which is kind of cool. Didn't know that. So again, thanks to Jordan Burke and Curtis Hayes for hipping me to that. And I want to just thank some folks who retweeted my Captain America Winter Soldier podcast, Matt Hurt, Richard Hall, David Alexander Smith, Jesse Privet, Chris Guinard, Scott Merrihew, Hedge Knight 84, and Jason Strong. Thanks to you guys for retweeting me. Really appreciate the retweets. Okay, so let's move into the genre news. I have a couple of items to report. It's probably way after the fact, but I did get a chance to see the trailer for the next DC animated film, Killing Joke. Looks very much right in line with Dark Knight Returns and Year One. I really appreciate, I think, the DC animated films more than I really like them. And I think because they're so close to the source material, like it really are, you know, scene by scene, just reproductions of the source material. So on one hand, the quality to which they do it, they have this guy, Christopher Drake, does the music. He did music for Dark Knight Returns Part 1 and 2, which was just beautiful. So they got like top-notch talent doing the artwork and the music, and you know, it's really well done. They take their time, and I really appreciate the amount of care that goes into these anime films. But at the same time, they're a little boring. I find them a little dull. I mean, I watch them because I like anime and I like well-produced anime, but they're a little dull. I thought it's the same problem that Zack Snyder's Watchmen had. I thought that they hewed too close to the source material, and I think sometimes when that happens, you know, the source material is one type of media. It works in a certain way, and it's drawn and constructed in a way that makes it work best for that media. And I think if you're going to translate something to another medium, you know, even if it's animated, you know, the motion picture medium, it's a different medium, and it has different requirements and different rules, and things work in motion pictures that do not work on graphic novels. Things work in graphic novels that do not work in motion. I think sometimes, you know, directors really get a little hung up with reproducing the graphic novel on film. And I find it kind of dull. I mean, I don't think it takes that much imagination to do that. I think what it really takes is a genius to understand the source material so well that you can translate it to movies. And it's just, it's my little rant on Zack Snyder's Watchmen, which I do not like at all. I just feel like the soul of Watchmen did not make it to the screen, even though, you know, page by page, it was all there. You know, like, and he argued to the suits to have Dr. Manhattan's penis be in the movie. And like, who cares? Like, he missed the boat so much on the soul of what the book is about, and reproduced it perfectly, you know? And so I think similar, I don't feel as impassioned by the animated DC stuff. Again, I'm impressed by it, and they're really rendering it well, and it's done well, but something's flat about all of them, I think. The ones that are take liberties with the source material, like the Red Hood and Batman and Son and stuff. And those are fun to watch. Those are like real, you know, they move and they're good. And but these ones that were done from Dark Knight Returns in year one, and I'm assuming Killer Joke will be similar. They're different animals, you know, definitely things to appreciate, but they're kind of lost on me. So anyway, the Killing Joke trailer looks good, and I think it'll be sort of a piece. So big news for Star Wars fans. They've cast young Han Solo. There's an actor named Alden Ehrenreich, who I believe was in Blue Jasmine. I think he was in a movie called Beautiful Creatures. And I think he was in Hail Caesar. A good friend of mine said it was the best thing about Hail Caesar. So 26 years old, he will be the new Han Solo. And I think the next standalone Disney movie after Rogue One is going to be a Han Solo standalone film, if I'm not mistaken. Who knows if that's... I know that's coming. I don't know if it's next, but I know it's coming. So it's kind of cool to know that was cast. I have no idea what that's going to be like. So, in other news, there's some rumblings in the DC universe, some chair shiftings. Ben Affleck has been officially invited in to produce the Justice League movie. So, if you've been reading and following this stuff for a while, you know, they've really been wooing Affleck into the fold. And I think they want him at the reins of the franchise as well as Zack Snyder, you know, or maybe eventually to supplant Zack Snyder, who knows? But so he's like officially now producing the Justice League movie, as well as earlier news where he was going to write and direct a solo Batman movie. So he is quite riding high these days, because I think he's been wanting to make a Batman movie his whole career. So, but at the same time, the director of the Flash standalone movie is gone, and there was rumors that James Wan was pulling out of Aquaman. So, you know, it's weird. Who knows what's going on? I mean, I think Batman v Superman made enough money where, you know, the franchise financially is fine, but the word of mouth and the critical drubbing was so bad that I do think they're kind of casting around back there. And it doesn't look like, you know, they have anyone at the reins. They don't have a Kevin Feige and Avi Arad shepherding this stuff through, you know, with sure hands that they did. Curious to see how the DC film franchise universe fares with all this. And one last bit of news that inspired a little subject that I want to talk about. You know, if any of you guys have been keeping up with the Daredevil Netflix series, the second series dropped a couple of weeks ago, and it featured the Punisher in a lot of the first half of the series, and then he comes back a little bit near the end. I saw it. I really liked it a lot. I loved what they did with the Punisher, with the character. The actor was really fantastic. Such a great, great character, and it was done so well. So impressed with what they did. So the news is now that the Punisher's getting his own series. They're going to give him his own Netflix series, right? So most people who enjoyed the second season of Daredevil and who loved the Punisher character are jumping up and down, and I am not. I have a theory about all this, and it also regards Wolverine. There are certain characters, I think, that are best expressed as side characters, because for two reasons. Number one, their characters aren't terribly complicated and interesting in a way of like you staying with the characters and getting to know them, right? And number two, that they are more impressive when they are coming out of the wings and mysterious and impactful characters on the main story. So what am I talking about? Well, my first example, I'll leave the Daredevil stuff for the second example. The first example is the X-Men film, Days of Future Past, right? So in the X-Men movies leading up to this, most of the X-Men films, Wolverine is a side character. He's an important character in the film, but for the most part, you know, you're with Xavier, or you're with Scott, or you're with Jean Grey, or you're, you know, with their young counterparts. And they're kind of pushing the through line of the movie, and Wolverine is sort of on the outside. He's the snarling sort of, you know, character who's like surly and doesn't really want to join, and he's kind of stuck with the rest of the group for now. And because that outsider status, to me, helps pop the character. Wolverine, definitely. And I think what happens is when you give Wolverine his own movie, I mean, I've seen the two Wolverine movies, and I don't think any of them are very good. Because Wolverine isn't that interesting a character. Like, I don't want to follow Wolverine as the hero's journey. Like, I don't want to know about his past when he was a kid. I don't really care about him losing a girl or him screaming up at the camera. No, like, Wolverine's the character who comes out of nowhere and, like, cuts people to pieces and snarls and then vanishes off into the night. And you're like, what was that? Like, and so in the Days of Future Past movie, Wolverine was the main character. Because his body could take it, they sent him back in time. And Wolverine is the main viewpoint character in the movie. And it doesn't, I never thought it worked. You know, him sitting there trying to get Magneto and Xavier to talk to each other. Like, it was so awkward. I'm like, this isn't Wolverine. He's not a peacemaker. He's not someone who's like rounding everyone up to do the right thing. He's being rounded up and being kind of pushed into doing the right thing, like the first X-Men movie. That's his character. That's what he is. And it's what makes him so cool, because he is the surly outsider. And you don't want to spend too much time behind the eyes of Wolverine, for me, because it's boring. Like, because it's not, that's not what's great about that character. What's great about that character is the mystery and the menace about what Wolverine really is and how dangerous he is. And the more I get inside of Wolverine and get to know who he is and how he ticks, the less mysterious he becomes, the less interesting he becomes. You know, certain characters get more interesting as you get inside of them. But a character like Wolverine, to me, does not. I don't want to know that much about him. I want him to be this dangerous guy on the outskirts that nobody messes with, and you don't know which way he's going to jump, and you don't know really where his allegiance is, right? So it's the same way with the Punisher. The Punisher, I think, worked so well in season two of Daredevil, because the main story was being carried by Daredevil and Foggy Nelson and, you know, the girl, I forget her name. And they were the main story, you know, and then the Punisher comes out of nowhere and he's driving the plot, but not the story. You know what I'm saying? Like, the story is being driven by what's going on with Matt Murdock, you know? And Matt Murdock's more of a complicated character. So we can get into Matt's life as a sort of, you know, as a lawyer, and then be interested in his life as Daredevil. There's complexity there, and he can hold the story. And then the Punisher comes out of nowhere and just starts driving the action. And whenever the Punisher enters the scene, or whatever the Punisher does, it's scary. I mean, it's tough and it's scary, and then he gets to have these wonderful monologues, and then he's out of the frame. You know, like, I don't want to spend a whole episode with the Punisher. I don't want to go back to his house and have him eat breakfast with me. I don't want the Punisher on a hero's journey. I don't want to know what makes him tick. Like, you know, I want to know a little bit of what makes him tick. But again, the Punisher to me is like Wolverine. They're best when they're mystery. They're best when they're mysterious characters. And they're coming in out of the shadows and doing stuff. And we're like, what is that? Who are these incredibly dangerous, mysterious characters? And then back out of the frame. And the story continues with other characters. So my prediction is that, you know, spending an entire season with Punisher as a viewpoint character is going to be so boring. It's going to be so overwrought. I mean, that wonderful monologue he has in the diner with the girl and in the graveyard, like, these beautiful monologues, right? Very powerful monologues. Really wonderfully written, wonderfully performed. But, like, if you give me 5 or 6 episodes of these things, it's gonna become like the Rorschach talk show. It's gonna be too much, you know, and I'm gonna know too much about it. The repetition of that type of thing is gonna get so old, and it's gonna be so boring and uninteresting after a while. He's just gonna become, you know, Rust Cole from True Detective. Yeah, after the 4th episode of that, you know, that show, you're just like, I'm done with this guy. I don't care anymore about his nihilistic, you know, Nietzschean philosophy. He's just boring and dull, right? So anyway, I'm to get a long way around to say that I am not excited about a Punisher show unless the main through line of the Punisher show is some brand new characters, and that they keep the Punisher, even in his own show, on the sidelines or in the shadows a lot. So you're not getting to know Frank Castle a lot, and you're not spending tons of time with Frank Castle. Now, Frank Castle, even in his own show, is kind of a shadowy character that we don't know too much about. That would be kind of cool. But I have a feeling that that's not going to be the case. So I think they've done, in the second season of Daredevil, they've done pretty much everything you can do with the Punisher as a character, and they've done it perfectly. And I don't really think you can do any more. I think anything more will simply dilute the impact of what happened in the second season. I think they are a victim of their own success. It's perfect. Every angle of Frank Castle's rage and motives, it's all there. It's all brilliantly done. So I am not a fan of them continuing. So anyway, I just kind of wanted to talk a little bit about that. Okay, so let's get to Solaris. What I'm going to do here is I'm going to talk a little bit about the novel to start, and then I'm going to talk about Tarkovsky and Soderbergh's films as they succeed or not in terms of developing the themes that were set out in the novel, because they both hew pretty close to the story of the novel for the most part. So it's kind of interesting to follow them. But I just wound up rereading the novel for this podcast, and I really was impressed. It really has grown in my estimation. Written by Stanislaw Lem, who's a Polish science fiction writer who wrote mostly in the 60s and 70s. There was recently a movie released about a year ago, maybe, with Robin Wright, called The Congress, and it was based on a Lem novel called The Futurological Congress. He wrote some of the books that have made it here, his memoirs of a space traveler and the Siberiad. He's written a bunch of stuff. He's written some scathing bromides against American English language science fiction, which are really interesting to read. Some of it's really good, but he doesn't have much good to say about it. But so Solaris the novel is really brilliant. And one of the things I really love about it is that it's one of those novels like 1984. It's one of those speculative fiction novels that you can read year after year after year because they don't really get specific about what's the future tech of their generation. I talked about this in an earlier podcast, right? Where, you know, in the 30s or 40s, the future was, you know, fins on cars, the Jetsons, right? It has a certain look. And the future of the 80s was like, you know, Japanese mega corporations ruling the world. It had a certain look and a certain flavor. The interesting thing about that is that the closer that writers of their time get to these futures that everyone's sort of agreeing on at the moment, and the more they get into the details of what they write about, the less the books travel down the centuries. You know, so science fiction, unfortunately, kind of has a built-in aging device. But stuff like War of the Worlds and 1984 and like Lem's book, they don't spend a lot of time getting too uber-detailed about the tech and the future stuff. It's done in very broad language. So in a weird way, the books travel better down the centuries, or down the decades, I should say. So you can read them. You know, you can still read Orwell's 1984, and it's not, you don't feel like the book was written in the 30s, because most of it takes place in kind of a quasi, you know, post-apocalyptic or dystopian future that's just far enough ahead, but not too far ahead, that it resembles, you know, it still resembles a future that we might look forward today, right? So Lem's novel's great in that way, and that even though, you know, you've got a guy journeying to a space station over a planet, he's not being specific about what kind of drive is being used, and, you know, describing if there are ray guns and gadgets and all the special stuff. And when he does talk about things that are quasi-scientific, he really bases it in as much real science as possible. And, you know, there are certain things that are described in the book that they use to try to destroy these guests, as they're called, when they manifest. You know, they're talking about, like, I think positrons and quarks and like real stuff of real physics. So it still rings true when you read it today, which is really fascinating. So anyway, it's a really great novel. I'm not going to go too much through the plot. I recommend definitely picking it up. It's just it was a really wonderful read. Some of the chapters can be a little slow going when he's describing, kind of like Borgesian, he's describing, you know, all of the nonfiction books that were written about Solaris, you know, these fictional books that were never written, and he goes very much into detail with them. And he will explain a lot about some of the manifestations of the planet itself in incredible detail. It can be a little slow going, I have to say, but in general, it's a hell of a book. So coming out of the book, I came out with like four different interpretations, the things that the book made me think about. And first of all, the first one was, I think, is what Lem really intended, of man's inability to ever make significant contact with a species that's so alien to us that there would be no common ground for understanding, right? So in a nutshell, you know, the Solaris plot is basically they're on the space station above this sort of living planet of kind of amorphous goo. It's alive and sentient in some way, but they can't communicate with it. And they find that it creates out of their memories when they're sleeping these, you know, whatever's foremost in your brain, the most precious person maybe. In your mind, you'll wake up the next morning and that person will be there, whether they were dead on Earth or alive. And, you know, they're made up, they're human as far as you can go. But they're created by Solaris. You know, there's basically this notion that Lem's getting at that, you know, can we ever make significant contact? Because they have no idea why the planet is doing it. There's been no significant communication between the planet and people. The whole thing has been, you know, human beings relating to their own unconscious. And that's his point. It's like, you know, he gets to this thing of like, you know, when we go out there, can we only relate to alien species through a version of our own experience, you know? So that's pretty cool. And then there's some other things that I kind of riffed on. You know, part of what happens here is, I think, that he gets at is that most of the guests that are manifested are loved ones of the, you know, the inhabitants of Solaris Station. And I got the idea of, you know, when we love other people, do we only love our mental construction of them and not who they are themselves, right? Which is kind of interesting. And you know, I think to myself sometimes if I'm in love with someone and they're not there and I'm thinking about them, really what I'm thinking about is my memory of them, not them, you know, and it's not a complete picture and I'm not And the longer I'm away from them, the more my memories and my own imagination takes what I know of them, and it becomes something completely different and not the person itself, right? I was inspired thinking about that when I was, you know, reading the book. Another thing the book made me think of is that perhaps God is so alien and experienced that the only way we can experience God can be reflected in our own experience. So, you know, we experience God through an incredibly narrow lens of our own memories and experiences, and that God couldn't be comprehended outside of our own notions, right? So if the planet Solaris is sort of, you know, a God-like construction, you know, our only experience of interacting with that God is that it creates manifestations of our own memories and realizes them, and we relate to that. And is that actually relating to God or not? So that was, I don't know, made me think of that. I think that was really cool. And then the last bit is definitely something Lem gets at himself, that human beings were really not looking for company in the universe, and that deep down we're not really looking we don't really want to know so much that we're not alone, but that we're looking for reflections of ourselves in other things constantly. Which is neat. It's another neat idea. And again, you know, it definitely is built into the structure of the novel itself. So those are the things that the novel brought out for me that I really thought were great. And, you know, some of them will be treated and some of them won't be treated as we go into the films. But I did want to talk about the novel because it is a jumping off point for both of these films. It's a really beautiful book. I highly encourage you to seek it out and give it a read and, you know, take your time and just let it kind of wash over you, because there's some beautiful stuff in it. So let's do a little bit of background on Tarkovsky Solaris. First, a little bit about Andrei Tarkovsky, if you guys don't know of him. Tarkovsky's dates are he was born in 1932 and died in 1986 at the age of 54 in Paris. So those are his dates. He is revered as one of the greatest directors of the 20th century by pretty much every director of note, of merit. He is universally acclaimed. And for a guy who's so acclaimed, he directed like 5 or 6 films. His first major film was called Andrei Rublev in 66. And then he directed Solaris in 72, a film called The Mirror in 1975, and Stalker in 1979. Then a film called Nostalgia in 83 and The Sacrifice in 86, and then died that same year. So if you don't know Tarkovsky, you know that his films are characterized by a long takes, unconventional dramatic structure, heavy on the dialogue and the heady stuff. You know, he really gets into really, really, you know, universal big themes. I've only seen Solaris and Stalker. Solaris and Nostalgia has been on my list for a while, but Tarkovsky's the kind of guy where you got to go to the theater, man. You know, for me personally, I won't make it through another, I think, Tarkovsky film in my apartment, you know, with so many distractions around. So Tarkovsky is the kind of guy, like Bergman, I need to go to a revival theater, put my ass in the middle of a row, and stay there. So for Solaris, Tarkovsky supposedly has two motives for adapting the novel. And the Lem's novel was written in 1961. And Tarkovsky really liked the book, but at second, he needed money because Andrei Rublev, which he directed in 66, had gone unreleased. And he had written a screenplay that had been rejected, which would later become The Mirror. But so he picked this novel, which was a popular and critical success in the USSR, and he figured, you know, commercial and artistic choice. So that's a little bit about Tarkovsky and his Solaris. And the other Solaris was written and directed by Steven Soderbergh, but it started out that James Cameron was looking to remake Solaris, and his production company, Lightstorm Entertainment, spent about 5 years trying to get the rights for both Stanislaw Lem and Mosfilm, which owns the Tarkovsky film as well. But he had tons of commitments in the 90s, so he could not take on the directing duties. In the 2000, around the time that Soderbergh was working on Traffic, he pitched his idea of Solaris to Cameron. Cameron was thrilled with what he heard, and the development began in earnest. As Traffic was wrapping up, Soderbergh began drafting a script using both Tarkovsky's film and the book as a reference. He soon wrote the screenplay. Soderbergh originally intended Daniel Day-Lewis to play the role of Kelvin, but Day-Lewis was busy with Gangs of New York. And since Clooney was Soderbergh's producing partner, having formed Section 8 Productions together, he was obligated to send Clooney a copy of the script. And a month later, during the editing of Ocean's 11, Clooney wrote him a letter saying he wanted the role of Kelvin. And in addition to fulfilling the role of director and screenwriter, Soderbergh also acted as the film's cinematographer and editor. Both were credited under pseudonyms. Let's get started comparing the films. The first part I will talk about is the part of the beginning of the films up until the character of Chris Kelvin receives his first guest of his ex-wife manifested by the planet Solaris. So we'll start off with Tarkovsky's film, and right away, you know, the Tarkovsky style is in full bloom. Tarkovsky's film clocks in at like 2 hours and I think 40 minutes or 2 hours and 30 minutes. Like, it's incredibly long. And I think Soderbergh's is like a buck and a half at best, you know. So definitely a lot different. Tarkovsky, right away, you know, you get a sense of his style. A lot of long, slow takes. Not a lot of movement. Hardly ever much movement going on the screen. He's such a very still director. And we start out in this film at Chris Kelvin's childhood home. His father is still alive, and this character, Henry Berton, who was on a mission to Solaris years ago, they all meet at the house. We watch this interview that Berton has given to, you know, this panel of people now that he's returned, when he returned from his Solaris mission. And he's narrating very specifically flying into the planet's unique structures, which morph and form. They're called mimoids and all these kind of crazy names. And the planet basically spontaneously creates all these alien structures, and then they dissolve out into nothing, and then it creates them again. Supposedly he caught some of it on camera, but when it's time for us to see it, it's basically, you know, white mist. Nobody believes him. Everybody thinks he's crazy. And again, this is the beginning of Tarkovsky's style, which is very much Tarkovsky's characters describe a lot of things, and especially in Solaris. They talk a lot about things that happened either before we're seeing the scene or things that are off camera. And Tarkovsky's not one to shoot those actual things. So lots of describing other scenes. It's almost like a filmed play in a certain way, in that way. So for whatever reason, Kelvin, our main character, is chosen. He's a psychologist. The folks, you know, the mission control people want to send him to Solaris Station to evaluate whether or not they should actually allow the station to continue to operate because they've lost contact, you know, with the other denizens of the station. Again, lots of beautiful photography, you know, very slow nature in and around this beautiful, you know, home where he lives. And we end with raindrops, you know, outside on teapots, long scene. So then in Tarkovsky's film, there's an attempt at a transition here from this bucolic backwater into, you know, a science fictional setting. And what we get is a long take of Kelvin driving through a long tunnel and then, you know, what purports to be a futuristic city. But I mean, even in 1972, I don't think this stuff looked that futuristic. And the vehicles don't either. So it's a weird stretch from this, we're at this country house, then we're in kind of a, you know, a mid-century Russian city, and then we're in space. And I think Soderbergh has the same problem where the transition to the Solaris station is just so abrupt. And I know Tarkovsky had gone on record saying that he hated 2001 because it was really like phony. And my suspicion is that what he didn't like is Stanley trying to create artificial future by showing models and long takes of ships going. For whatever reason, Tarkovsky maybe found that false, you know. And that it wasn't a true representation, that you were dazzling your viewers and sort of hoodwinking them and getting out of, you know, what he may have termed, you know, realism and truth. So he very much stays away from that. He does very little of it. And frankly, I think the film bores me because of it. You know, it never feels like a science fiction film, and I know that's on purpose. Like, this is not Tarkovsky's bag. He wanted to use a science fictional concept to tunnel into some deep truth. But to my mind, I mean, when you're watching a science fiction film, there's something about those futuristic trappings that pull you out of, they allow you to drop your, you know, your realist fences, as it were, and they open your mind up to the fact that you're going to be in, you know, a different place, and maybe you can process what's going on in a different mode, you know, where Tarkovsky doesn't seem to think that's true. I actually do think it's true. So I think his slavishness to what he deems truth makes his films very boring, especially the sci-fi films. And I feel the same way with Stalker. I'll get to that near the end about why I'm not a fan of his films, even though I respect the hell out of the guy. So we get, you know, a little bit of Solaris Station. It's okay. 1972 sci-fi, right? You can't, you know, 2001 is really a standout. The station looks okay for a run-of-the-mill sci-fi. Some decent production design inside, but I don't know, you know, it kind of reminded me of Andromeda Strain a bit, like solid for the times, but nothing out of the ordinary. The actor playing Snout in Tarkovsky's film is really terrific. I really like him a lot. I kind of wish he was Kelvin in a way. There's some of this, he's got these wide eyes that are really neat. I don't know, it's just he's a very expressive actor, and I really like him. And so, you know, about an hour of this film passes until we get Kelvin's first guest, his wife, the representation of his wife that's created by Solaris. So, you know, because of the fidelity of the images and the slowness, there is some kind of weight of mystery here, which I do like, which is sorely lacking in Soderbergh's film, which kind of jumps right into things. But even though, you know, even so, like where Tarkovsky's film is going, like I don't know that all of the weight of this buildup really lends itself to deepening what's going to happen as we're on Solaris. You know, for me personally, like I don't need this hour of stuff at and the slowness of the pace here. You know, I'm someone who enjoys a slow paced film very much, and certain directors can really hypnotize me, and I really enjoy a film that takes its time if I'm hypnotized by it. But I'm not hypnotized by Tarkovsky's camera here. I just find it kind of turgid. Now let's switch over to Soderbergh, the Soderbergh part of the movie where he leads us up to Kelvin getting his first guest. And man, he gets us right into the action. You know, during the main sequence of the movie when he's on Solaris, he'll flash back more to events that happened before the film, which I think is, I like the attempt. He's going to focus much more on the pre-Solaris relationship between Kelvin and his wife, whereas Tarkovsky really is not interested too much in that. He's after kind of other game as well. We see something very telling in the beginning of the film where Kelvin's, you know, he's preparing a meal for himself and he cuts his finger very noticeably, right? And so that's going to telegraph in later. You know, that's going to come into play near the end of the film. Cinematography, which is by Soderbergh himself, very crisp and clean. This is a very modern film, very nicely shot. You know, it has a real great crispness to it. Again, there's that same disconnect because what we're introduced to on Earth when we meet Kelvin is a very similar to our present, and I'm not getting into sort of a science fictional concept. So when he's later on the space station, it's I don't know, there's just something missing. I think both of the directors kind of missed the boat here, and that I don't feel like we're in strange territory or we're in some kind of science fictional world. It's like we're just in a different set. I don't really think both of the setups work, frankly. And I'm jarred both times once I'm on Solaris and how quickly I'm there and how I'm not ready for it. But I do have to say about Soderbergh's film, for me personally, the star of his movie is the soundtrack composer, Cliff Martinez. And the soundtrack for Solaris is beautiful. I mean, it's just beautiful. And I encourage anyone who might be interested to go check it out who likes good soundtrack work. It's sort of like, you know, a lot of the composers in 2001, but put through a whole modern lens, and just beautiful, beautiful synthesizer work by Cliff Martinez. So it really helps maintain an amazing mood in this film. And Solaris, the planet, looks really cool in Soderbergh's version. It's kind of surrounded by these cloud formations or mists that reach above and beyond it. Tarkovsky's version is, you know, the photography back then wasn't so great, so it doesn't look too great, but I really like Soderbergh's photography here. And so we meet the Snout actor in the remake, and he's this terrible, terrible performance. I don't really like the choice that the Snout actor plays. He's a real problem for the film. It reminds me of the kind of the stuff that Brad Pitt was doing in 12 Monkeys, the very histrionic, physical hand-wringing, and it's just bad. It's just a really bad performance, and I don't like any of the choices that he's made. The rub is, he never seems like a real character, and at the end of the film, the reveal is that he's not a real person. He's, you know, he's a Solaris construct that killed the original, which is a twist that really makes no sense in terms of the theme of the movie. But even so, you know, like if you're going to do something, make it compelling. Don't be like, well, you know, we're going to put an actor on screen. He's going to be really bad. It's almost going to be like a bad actor. And I could see in a way the creator of the film saying like, yeah, that's the way a copy would be trying to act like a real person. It would be like it was a bad actor. And yet, but I'm in the audience and I'm watching it and he's a bad actor. So it's one of those things where you can tell me why you've done something and I could say, yeah, that's great. But you know, I still have to watch it. And the one thing to note here is, like, unlike Tarkovsky, who takes an hour, 20 minutes in, Kelvin's asleep, you know, so we're getting right into the mix here pretty quickly. The next part of the scene is the arrival of the first guest and the reaction of Chris Kelvin. So Tarkovsky, again, we get the appearance of his wife, who's named Harry, but the actor playing Kelvin in Tarkovsky's version is not very expressive. He doesn't express much with his eyes or his face. He has kind of the same expression through most of the film. It's like slightly pained, slightly confused. So, you know, when he realizes that she's not really his wife and he goes and puts her in the rocket and blasts her off the station, there's no really emotion in it for me. The novel has the interiority of what Kelvin's going through in that moment, which allows me to kind of ride along as he's making the decisions to blast the first copy out into space. So you kind of understand what's going on. And I don't feel like the film, either film, Tarkovsky or Soderbergh, really gets at that. And Soderbergh as well. I mean, Clooney at least tries to give us a performance to make us feel like what it might be like to have this kind of thing happen. You know, he gets up, he's trying to, hitting himself in the face as if he's still asleep. But as much as I love Clooney, he's not the world's greatest actor. So I appreciate that he's trying, but it just seems kind of clunky. There's just a lot of wide-eyed staring from Clooney and a lot of flat dialogue. But in both cases, I don't really buy the quick transition to, you know, ejecting this creature out of the lab.
Don't tell me they don't use money in the 23rd century.
Well, we don't.
Yes, my friends, but we do use money in the 21st century. Let's think about $1 for a minute. If you contribute $1 per episode via Patreon, it's $4 a week, $52 a year. If you like what I'm doing at Sci-Fi on Screen, you're really enjoying the show, I invite you to become a Patreon subscriber. My first goal I'm setting is $50 per show. I'm at about $26 and change right now. At $50 a show, I would really like to improve the quality of the sound for you guys, and I could buy a really good microphone and a booth so you guys can get the best sound I could possibly provide. So $1 a show a week. Sign up at patreon.com/sci-fi on screen. There's a button on my website, takes you right to the site. Signing up is a snap, and you're on your way. Until the 23rd century does arrive and we no longer need money, I would love your support via Patreon. Thanks for listening.
Blah, blah, blah,
blah, blah, blah, blah, blah. No, blah, blah, blah!
So I'll follow the rest of the films briefly. The Tarkovsky, when Harry reappears again, quickly Kelvin like says, this is my wife, and he begins to love her. And it's a shift, again, in both films that I just don't quite buy. And again, Tarkovsky does this thing where Kelvin narrates parts of their relationship to her, saying, well, this is what you were like and this is what happened on Earth, rather than show us. And why not use the medium of film to show us the relationship instead of simply telling? So not too fond of how Tarkovsky's style works in this film. And then maybe there's this dinner conversation scene where, you know, the character of Snout is speaking about Lem's thesis about man needing mirrors and not really wanting to contact other life in the universe, right? And it's the theme of the novel, partially the theme of the film. You have Sartorius, who is there, and his MO is he's a seeker of knowledge, and he's all, you know, intelligence and knowledge-based. And then Harry has her little monologue, where she says, interestingly, that Kelvin continues to love me, despite the fact that I'm not really his wife, and that I'm not even human, and that even though there are new definitions and new circumstances, that the fact that I'm humanoid, that Kelvin is better than both of you, because he's decided to love, where these other two men are rejecting their guests and keeping them confined and eventually want to destroy them. And she's, you know, sort of tells us as well that she's become a human being. She's starting to feel, she's able to love. She can spend more and more time away from Kelvin. But again, you know, it's like a 20-25 minute scene of just speech after speech after speech. The camera is just kind of following them around, and it's not very interesting cinema, to be completely honest. So I don't think either film gets at why the wife tries to kill herself. They both have her drinking liquid oxygen. And afterwards, then we get this whole monologue from Kelvin about the nature of suffering of mankind and the impossibility of understanding and what life's purpose. And later on, there's more expounding about the meaning of life and how happy people rarely seek life's meaning, and unhappy people are always thinking about what the meaning of life is, which, you know, interesting concepts. And he decides that he's going to stay on the station and wait for what comes next, after his wife commits suicide. Kind of allusions to a waiting for Godot or God kind of thing. And again, you know, a huge chunk of Tarkovsky's Solaris is just people walking around, talking and having long monologues, and nothing. You know, what they're saying at times does have profundity to it, I will admit, but It's not enough. I'm sitting in a seat for, you know, 2 hours and 30 plus minutes, not to just watch speeches. I want to see some cinema. I would like to see something being done with the camera, not just, you know, a filmed play, which Solaris is kind of a filmed play in a way. And, you know, there are insert shots from here and there with the planet, showing us things going on with the planet. But it's just very, very, you know, I feel like things in Tarkovsky's film are very just one thing happens after another, but they don't gel into something. And I'll get to that later on. But so the end of Tarkovsky's film, the wife has killed herself. And because of part of the plot, which is they've beamed Kelvin's brainwaves into the planet now realizes that it's causing distress to the human beings by creating these guests. So the guests have ceased to be created. So Kelvin goes down to the planet and lives on Solaris. But it's actually the way the film ends is that we think he's back home on Earth at his father's house, and there's weird scenes where it's raining inside the house, and then all of a sudden, Kelvin collapses on his knees in front of his dad, and the camera slowly pans out more and more and more, and we see that this bucolic place is actually the house of his father, but at this time, it's been recreated on Solaris for Kelvin, and that's sort of his heaven, as it were, you know, or his love, or whatever that is. And that's where he's going to spend the remainder of his days. And it's a very effective last scene. There's some really cool music and sound that's mixed together as the camera's pulling back. And when we realize that it's there on Solaris, it is kind of impactful. So I kind of like it. And, you know, the idea for me is that if he's become one with God, that, you know, he can only know God by interacting with things that God would create from his experience, right? Or his memories, and the most powerful ones here are of childhood and his father. And we could think of that, you know, as like God the Father, in a sense. The only way we could relate to God the Father is the way we kind of would relate to our own father, you know? So again, interesting ideas in all of the Tarkovsky stuff, very much, but his style is, oh my God, it's so boring for me personally. So wrapping up the Soderbergh film, you know, when Kelvin goes back to sleep, his sleep periods are longer. And during his sleep periods, as he's dreaming, the film shows us now the relationship between Kelvin and his wife. Now, I think that's a solid idea, but what they choose to show us is so adolescent. In a sense, if you're trying to show bones of a relationship between two people, what Soderbergh is showing us is the meet cute scene, them flirting and laughing, eating naked, all of their little cute slyness and how beautiful they are and their attractiveness. And for me, it's like all of the superficial arts of love, you know, it's like a Harlequin romance. There's nothing real here that later on when Kelvin decides that he's going to try to love her again, I'm like, why? It was no relationship to begin with, you know, like the whole relationship was just two hot people doing fun things and laughing together. And then, you know, when she became depressed and suicidal, he left. It's like, so there's no meat there for me. I think in some weird way, Soderbergh wants me to be so charmed by their relationship that when Kelvin decides later on that he's going to love her, that I'm on board with him and I really want that to happen. But I don't care because the relationship he's shown me has been very, very superficial. And then later on, and I feel like both films suffer from this, like you don't really see what's going on in the actor in the Tarkovsky film because his face is so impassive. But here, Clooney is very effusive about, you know, because part of the plot is in both films and the book is that in this relationship with Kelvin and his wife, she threatened to commit suicide and he decided one day that he had to get out of there and her threats be damned and she did kill herself. So, you know, that's supposed to make us feel some guilt, which, I mean, was he going to stay there the rest of his life because she threatened him? You know, like he could never leave. So it's a little shallow for me. But the thing of it is that Kelvin in the guise of Clooney is like, I came back. He, in the Tarkov, you know, in the Soderbergh film, of course, it's a little more Hollywood. After he leaves, he changes his mind and comes back to her, but it's too late. She's already killed herself. And so, of course, he blames himself. But so he wants to make it work with the double, not because, to me, as I'm watching it, it's like not because there's any real love here, but because he feels so guilty. And this is a way of atoning. And part of Soderbergh's thing is that, you know, that this forgiveness is part of what Solaris offers. And I don't think he did anything wrong, you know, like what is he supposed to do? Never leave this woman when she's, you know, threatening him? Is he supposed to stay there his whole life and that's being a good person? So I don't know. It's very adolescent in what it's dealing with, you know? And at some point, I feel like what was interesting about the Tarkovsky film is that the wife has a brief monologue where she's like, you know, Kelvin's more human than any of you, and that he decides to continue to love despite the extreme circumstances. And I thought that was a neat idea. I don't know that Lem got at that. I feel like Tarkovsky did, and I thought that was clever. And in the same moment in Soderbergh's film, Rhea, I guess the wife's called Rhea. She's like, am I really Rhea? Kelvin's like, I don't know. All I see is you. And I feel like Soderbergh's afraid to buttonhole us and say, I think the answer here is, it doesn't matter if you're her or not, that I love you. And I don't think he gets it. I think that's what he's trying to get, but I don't think he hits it. It was interesting that he was trying to get at the same thing, but I feel like he missed it. And then there's the reveal that Snout was killed by his Solaris copy, which doesn't make any sense at all in the film. It's just, to me, it's like a Hollywood trope, like it's the little twist ending, which means nothing to any of the characters at all. And at the end, it's a very similar ending than Tarkovsky, where, you know, this time it's the whole finger. He cuts his finger and it heals right away. He's now back at his house as he was in the beginning of the film, and Rhea is there, and now he's with her, and that's it. And I feel like what Soderbergh's saying here is that, you know, his stab at heaven is everything we've ever done has been forgiven, which I like, and you live inside a never-ending love, which the only way it could be done with this version of Kelvin is a never-ending love with his partner. So I understand the choice he makes, sort of what transcendent love is for Kelvin is nestled inside his relationship to Rhea. It's just no real relationship with Rhea. So, you know, it's kind of hollow at the end of the day. And again, Clooney's trying here, but he's too glib of a performer. He can do, like, Michael Clayton, he was unbelievable. He can do earnest and hangdog really well, but I think it needed more here, and I think he gave it a great try, but I just think the themes were too powerful for Soderbergh's kind of take on it. But so anyway, to summarize the two, and I want to talk a little bit about Tarkovsky, like, all of the talking, this is exactly what happens in the film Stalker by Tarkovsky. You know, There's a parts of Stalker where guys are walking around the zone, which is this, you know, zone that aliens have left behind after they've left. And it consists of them walking around these fields, throwing a washer and nut tied to a white cloth. And they throw it, and then they walk to it and pick it up and then throw it again. And throughout this whole time, they have these conversations. And I thought, this is what I don't like about Tarkovsky, is that he refuses to push past the mundane. You know, what he tries to do is he focuses for hours, you know, for hours on end on real things, to the point where they, you know, I think to him, they may become surreal. Like, if I focus on a flower and rain for a half hour, eventually it's going to become something you've never seen before. Whereas I like the truthfulness of just, show me something I haven't seen before, dude. You know, think it up. Make it a model. The truth is truth. And however you derive at it, doesn't matter. You know, like, but his films are like lectures. I'd rather have someone say, you know, take all Tarkovsky's films and reduce them to a set of lectures. I would go watch the lectures. But there's rarely anything cinematically interesting going on for me. And I know Tarkovsky fans are probably howling, and that's fine. I get it. But this is a very personal thing to me. And I just, his images don't really do it for me. The mood he sets as well is dull as hell. I'm sitting in a theater looking at visual medium, and there's just a lot of people yakking and not much cinematically interesting to me. So I never really understood Tarkovsky. Maybe when I get older, he might pop with me. Like him and Bergman, very similar. I've had a very difficult time trying to get into them because of a lot of, you know, they're very still and subtle with the camera. And I'm maybe growing up on an incredibly kinetic type of filmmaking. It's lost on me. But anyway, it's not very cinematic for me. And, you know, the scenes, Tarkovsky scenes don't really knit together into a film. They're just, it's like a scene after a scene after a scene after a shot of Solaris. And it doesn't really knit together into something more powerful, which is what I'm obviously trying to do. There's no organicness in Tarkovsky's movie. It just feels very schematic, diagrammatic. When Kelvin declares he loves her, I don't really buy it. She's kind of a plaything of his. And I can't tell if Tarkovsky is just kind of sexist as the times were, or he's playing with this idea of what love is. But yeah, it just does not fly for me. And Soderbergh, I mean, his style is very direct. And in a weird way, I think Soderbergh needed more subtext. There needs to be more subtext in his movie. His movie was so on the nose and direct, but the themes are so big and powerful that it seems kind of awkward in a way when they're speaking of these things. It comes off as a little glib and a little perfunctory. So I don't get the power of Lem's novel for me in either film. Tarkovsky obviously gives it a hell of a try with his camera and the meditative pace of it, but Soderbergh tries to get into the actuality of the relationship, but I feel like on both ends, they don't really work for me. So that was my rather jumbled and clumsy attempt to talk about Solaris, the novel, and the films. So I appreciate you listening. I hope it was interesting in some ways. These were some tough films to tackle for me because they weren't, you know, my first choice, but I really liked the novel and I really thought I would try to get into what some of the films did. Hope it was interesting, and I'll see you next time.